Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It is that time of year once again when we celebrate one of my favorite holidays, the 4th of July here in the United States, as it happens to focus on one of my favorite periods of American history, the founding era of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. For the past 7 years, we have featured a number of scholars talking about the faith of the Founding Fathers, religion during that era, and even a debate between three scholars as to whether or not Christians should have fought in the Revolutionary War. Today we feature a discussion of another Founding Father we have yet to cover in our discussions, Benjamin Franklin, perhaps one of the most widely known characters of that era. And to that end, we are pleased to be joined by a scholar who has appeared twice before on our show, and one who pops up regularly during our annual Thanksgiving show. That scholar is Professor Thomas Kidd, a distinguished professor of history at Baylor University and the associate director of the Institute for Studies of Religion, the fine sponsor of our podcast. Dr. Kidd has been on a breakneck pace of cranking out a new book roughly once a year with some recent titles, including American Colonial History, Clashing Cultures and Faiths, Baptists in America, A History, co-authored with Barry Hankins, who also appeared on our podcast, George Whitefield, America's Spiritual Founding Father, Patrick Henry, First Among Patriots, God of Liberty, A Religious History of the American Revolution, and most recently, Benjamin Franklin, The Religious Life of a Founding Father, out this year with Yale University Press and the topic of our discussion today. He has a handful of other monographs not mentioned here, but we will be sure to point you back to all of these titles at our website, along with his previous podcast interviews on the Pilgrims and another one on the Great Awakening. Tommy, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
I just looked this up, and the last time we had you on was back in November of 2010, when we were roughly about 6 months old on this podcast. We talked about the Pilgrims, but it was such an awesome interview that we've run it again as an encore presentation a couple times since it has become a standard bearer of our Thanksgiving podcast show. Between that appearance back then and now, which was about 6.5 years ago, you've managed to publish, if I count correctly, 7 books. I mean, holy moly, what is the secret to doing that?
Well, I like writing, and I have a great situation here at Baylor for being able to publish with a low teaching load and summers off for writing. A lot of people don't understand that professors often are writing during the summer and not teaching. They think that if you're not teaching, that means the summer is off, but I'm actually, you know, like today, I'm working on writing things, and so yeah, it's you know, I just really enjoy writing in these areas, and have had a lot of doors open to me.
That's fantastic. I thought you were going to say that your first appearance on the podcast was a massive inspiration to write more books and get on there. But
Indeed.
Well, we're here today to talk about Benjamin Franklin, probably one of the most recognized figures next to Washington and maybe Jefferson in America's late colonial history. We know how historical figures often get inflated into mythic proportions over time, and their history is often embellished. Is there any myth surrounding Franklin that you think warrants some kind of correction here as a historian?
Yeah, well, aside from, you know, that we don't really understand his religious faith very well, I mean, there are certainly myths about it. I mean, I think some people have the impression that Franklin discovered electricity, which is not, I mean, his accomplishments in electricity were quite impressive. But what he was really doing was trying to understand the way that electricity is transmitted from clouds down into the ground, and wasn't understood whether lightning actually was electricity or not, or whether it was just something else. And so his discoveries were quite important, but they were part of a much longer flow of understanding about the science of electricity. So His accomplishments are stunning enough without having to credit him with somehow discovering electricity or something like that.
Yeah, there is always that picture of him with the kite. And did that kite thing really happen? I think they did that in Mythbusters once or something.
Right. The kite thing really did happen. It was an extraordinarily dangerous thing for him to do because he was trying to draw lightning into the kite, and then he would put his knuckle up to a piece of metal and it started sparking electricity. Someone, I think in Russia, tried to recreate the experiment a year or two later and was struck by lightning and died. So that could have been it for Franklin. Right there. He was quite lucky or blessed to not get killed doing that experiment.
Well, talking about being blessed doing that experiment, the cover of your book has a picture of this. He has his knuckle holding up. Now, as you mentioned that, and I just see his knuckle is up there, and there's a little shock coming from the key that's on the kite mm-hmm. string. But interestingly enough, in the background, there's a bunch of cherubs. It's something that you might see in Renaissance religious art or something. And so we want to talk a little bit about his religious background. And you focus, the focus of your book is mostly through the first half of his life, although you cover it all the way till the very end. But you really focus on the formation of his religious experience. So let's start instead at the beginning. Let's start at the end in circa 1790, because that's when everybody is thinking about where Franklin is at the time. Where was his spirituality at the time of his death?
So he had gone on a long journey. He lived a very long life for the time, lived into his 80s, and so he grew up in a very traditional Puritan family, but became skeptical about Christianity in his teens, or at least about Puritan versions of Christianity. Became quite a radical skeptic for a while, but for a variety of reasons that I know we'll talk about, he can't quite get away from the faith of his parents entirely. He has factors that are holding him closer to the religious background of his youth. And then when you get into the later stages of his life, the American Revolution and the Constitution, I think he becomes more and more convinced that that God by providence plays a role in human history and is playing a role in the events of the American Revolution. And it's actually quite handy that right at the very end of his life, 5 weeks before he died, Ezra Stiles, who was the president of Yale and also a Congregationalist pastor, asked Franklin directly. He said that he wanted to know what Franklin thought about religion, but also specifically about Jesus. And Stiles, I think, was a little concerned about whether Franklin was all set spiritually or not. And Franklin wrote him back and spoke very directly about his religious beliefs at the time, that he believed that there was a creator God, that God operated in history through providence, that there would be a future judgment by God, and so that people would, their souls would continue into an afterlife to face judgment by God. And that the most important thing we can do to serve God is to serve our fellow man. And these really were pretty consistent themes of Franklin's beliefs, through his 30s and 40s up through his 80s. I think they became even stronger, though, during the American Revolution and the framing of the Constitution, especially his belief in providence. But Franklin also told Stiles that he was not sure about Jesus, and especially whether Jesus was divine, whether Jesus was fully the Son of God or not. And he said he wasn't sure about that, but he figured he would find out soon enough anyway. still kind of joking about things, as Franklin always did there at the end of his life. And like I said, he died 5 weeks later. So that's how we have a very clear picture of what Franklin believed at least 5 weeks before his death.
Ever the experimenter, saying, "Yeah, I'll check it out in about five more weeks." So,
right.
If I go down this list that you just mentioned, creator, God, providence, future judgment, sirs, fellow man, those four sounds like standard Christianity. We get some iffiness here on the issue about Jesus's divinity. Nonetheless, most people characterize Franklin as a deist. He's one of the deist folks at the time. Thomas Jefferson is the other big name that's thrown around in this camp. What is deism, and would he really kind of qualify in that camp?
Well, we know Franklin was a deist because he says in his autobiography he was a deist, and he talks about abandoning his parents' faith and reading deistic writings. He said he became a thorough deist. But the problem with that is that deism could mean a lot of different things in the 18th century, very radical skepticism about virtually everything about Christianity, and a belief in the classic cosmic watchmaker God who had wound up the world and set it running, but then went off somewhere else to do something else and is not paying attention to human beings anymore. So that's one end of the spectrum on deism, but the other would be people who are just have doubts about some basic tenets of Christianity, like the divinity of Christ, or who are just critical, for instance, of Calvinist doctrine. And that's a big part of Franklin's deism, is that he is skeptical about some aspects of his parents' faith, such as the predestination of the elect to salvation, the entire reliability of the Bible. Some of those ideas, they're not necessarily that radical for the time, but they still get lumped in with deism. So deism could mean a lot of different things in the 18th century, and I think I'm still comfortable with the idea that Franklin was a deist, especially because he said he was a deist. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was some kind of radical skeptic, especially after that early run he made in his teens and 20s into very radical skepticism for a little while, but then he backed off of that.
Let's go ahead and do that and boomerang back to his early childhood to hear about these teenage years. But let's start first with his upbringing as a small child, maybe as, you know, teens up to his mid-teens or so. You used the word tether a number of times in the opening pages of your book as a way of saying that Franklin at the end of his life was still tethered to that very first formative decade or two. Tell us about that decade.
Right. So he grows up in a very devout Puritan family. His parents had moved from England. His father had moved from England in the 1680s, and a modest family. His father was a candle maker and a tradesman, but of very serious faith. And so Franklin and his brothers and sisters would have grown up in an environment where Bible study, Bible reading, catechism, and church attendance were just absolutely central to everything that they were doing, probably going to church two or three times a week, hearing sometimes sermons that could last up to 2 hours that were heavily doctrinal. Franklin was, as you would guess, he was a very bright boy, and he loved to read. And he tells us in the autobiography that he had read the whole Bible through by the time he was 5. Maybe that's true or it's not true, but I suspect he had heard and read a lot of it by the time he was 5. And so the Bible in particular had such a formative impact on Franklin's mind, the way that he thought and categorized things, the way he talked, the way he wrote. It was deeply shaped by biblical concepts, but also just the language of the King James Bible itself. It was the most common source of his similes and anecdotes, and it was a very common source of jokes he would play on people. And he knew that he knew the Bible better than most of his friends, and so he sometimes would trot out something and say, "See this passage? Don't you know this is from Genesis?" And they'd say, "Oh yes, I remember that from Genesis." Well, it wasn't from Genesis, and he would laugh at them. It was everywhere in his life, and even as he becomes more skeptical, that can't erase the memory, the legacy, the influence on him of the Bible and those personal relationships he had with devout Christians.
One of those devout Christians was his sister, Jane. Tell us a little bit about her and the influence that she played on Ben throughout his life.
So Jane was his closest sibling throughout their adult lives. A lot of his siblings he didn't have much contact with, but he tried very hard to stay in regular contact with Jane, who stayed behind in Boston. She married very young, I think when she was 15, which is young even for the colonial period. And she had a very difficult life. Many of her children preceded her in death. And she and her husband were always at the point of destitution financially. And so I think Franklin felt an obligation to kind of watch out for Jane and take care of her. But they would also routinely talk about and sometimes fight about religious issues, because Jane was an evangelical Christian and a Calvinist. And she would tell him that his belief in the importance of virtue for salvation, I mean, he came to believe that if people are saved into heaven, that it's only on the basis of good things that they do. And this, to evangelical Christians and to Calvinists, was just utterly unacceptable doctrine, that we're saved only by the grace of God, not by anything good that we do. And so they would talk about this. They would, and as I said, one time he visited her in Boston, and they apparently fought about this. Sometimes it's hard to track because, unfortunately, virtually all of Jane's letters to Franklin have been lost. I think maybe being regarded as not that important, which is just tragic. But Franklin's responses to her have virtually all been saved. And so they talk about, you know, I'm sorry, we had this disagreement. And he tries to explain how his views are actually Christian and biblical views, even though he doesn't believe in the idea of salvation by grace alone. So that relationship is one of two or three that are the most important for Franklin in tethering him, as you said, to the traditional faith of his parents. You know, if all we focused on is, you know, what he wrote about and theoretically what he said about doctrine and Christianity, that would be one thing, but we have to remember that he has close friends and family members who are traditional believers who he's talking to regularly about faith. And I think Franklin is concerned that he doesn't want them to think that he's going to hell. He wants them to think that he's okay spiritually, and so he talks about these things with them all the time.
Give us a brief summary of what American religiosity was at that time, or at least in the areas that he was growing up in the New England area. You mentioned Calvinism, the Reformed Calvinist tradition, and that grace alone is what saves you. What other interesting characteristics does the religious landscape have at this time that Franklin finds himself as a kind of an odd fit with?
Well, certainly New England is the most religious, the most uniformly religious part of the colonies, having been founded by the Puritans in the 1630s. Even when Franklin is born in the early 1700s, New England is still intensely religious, and his experience as a boy with a deep exposure to the Bible and church would have been just totally typical for the time. It is becoming more diverse religiously in New England. I mean, the Puritans didn't even tolerate other kinds of Protestants. They you know, for instance, they outlawed Baptists, and so they wouldn't allow Baptists and Anglicans and Quakers to be around. But that changed in the 1690s. England forced the Massachusetts colony, in particular, to change its laws about tolerating Protestants. They don't have to tolerate Catholics yet, and certainly not any kind of non-Christians they don't have to tolerate. But it's becoming more diverse, and so Franklin, some of his earliest writings are about the challenge of the Church of England ministers that starts to become very public in the 1720s. And then, of course, when he goes to Philadelphia, it's a very different situation. Also, many, many devout people, but founded by the Quakers, which the Puritans would have considered to be fanatics and totally unacceptable, but Philadelphia has lots of different kinds of religious groups. And so Franklin, I think, is drawn by his experience of the growing experience with religious diversity to moderate some of his views about, you know, what you have to believe in order to be saved, what you have to believe in order to be fully biblical in your views. He just thinks that because of the realities of religious diversity, those kind of doctrinaire versions of Christianity just can't stand.
So you mentioned the Quakers, and they're going to become important in his educational influence. And by education, we don't necessarily mean formal education sitting in a classroom. This was a bright kid, and he learned from a lot of different places. Give us a sense of Ben Franklin's education experience.
Well, Franklin is very, very deeply educated, but it's almost all dependent on his home education. He has almost no formal schooling at all, which makes his later accomplishments even more amazing. He is sent to school for about a year when he is around 12, but at a school that would later become Boston Latin. But at that time, his parents, knowing how smart he was, had started to think that he might go on to become a pastor. But I think it's unclear exactly what happened, but my belief is that once he went off to school, his parents also started to realize that he was developing some doubts about traditional doctrine, and so that's why they took him out of school. And ended up apprenticing him to his older brother, James, which was a difficult assignment to have to be an indentured servant at that time. And there was no chance from that point that he was ever going to go to Harvard. So, he was very deeply educated and learned because he would read everything he could get his hands on, including the Bible, but also very early reading John Bunyan, starting to read classics of Greek and Roman antiquity. So he's very educated, but not in a sense of going to formal schooling.
So this leads him to kind of buck the trend in many ways, and part of his story here is his teenage rebellion years, including a running away to Philadelphia by the time he was about 17 years old. So give us a sense of what is happening in his teenage years.
As I said, his parents are growing concerned about the state of his faith and beliefs, and his father, as I said, is a very devout Puritan, and he decides that he'll give Franklin some anti-deist writings, in other words, some writings by traditional Christians attacking deism, and that he hoped that this would turn Franklin away from his growing skepticism. But Franklin says in his autobiography that these books actually had the unintended effect of making him even more interested in deism, because he thought that the traditional Christian arguments were not very strong. And so he gravitates towards what the deists are saying instead, and that's the point at which he says that he becomes a thorough deist.
What else is going on with him in terms of rebellion at this time? One of the facts, actually, I have to ask this because I did not know this in reading your book. He turned to vegetarianism for a while, right?
He did. He, like you said earlier, he's an experimenter, and he's reading just all kinds of different religious writings. And one book that he comes across is A Christian Case for Vegetarianism. And this is not that unusual in the 18th century that there were some Christians who thought that not that different from arguments for vegetarianism today, that killing animals in order to eat them is cruel and unnecessary, and so we shouldn't do it. And so Franklin tries that for a while, and he also likes vegetarianism because he finds that it saves him money. And so he says, instead of buying meat, I'll buy books and read more books. And so he tries to be a vegetarian for a while, but then in a hilarious scene in his autobiography, he finds that some of his friends, I think when he was traveling on a ship, were catching fish, and frying it up, and he thought, oh, it smells so good. I'm not sure I want to be a vegetarian anymore. And then when they were cleaning the fish, they opened the fish's stomach and found that the fish had been eating fish. And so Franklin reasoned. He said, well, if you think it's okay, Mr. Fish, to eat other animals, then surely it should be okay for me to eat you. And so he dines on fish. And he plays around with vegetarianism some more in the coming years, but he's basically done with that experiment at that point.
Sounds good. He was also a prolific writer when he was fairly young, and he always plays around with pseudonyms. And one of his first pseudonyms was Silence Do-Good. Tell us about Silence Do-Good. Actually, but first, tell us about the role of pseudonyms in writing back that time, because he has, I don't know, dozens of these things.
It is very common for people in the 18th century to use pseudonyms when they're writing. Sometimes it doesn't have any obvious reason behind it. I mean, it was just the style of the time. But there were definitely times when Franklin would write things, including Silence Do-Good, that he did not want it to be known that he was the author. This is his first series of writings, was the Silence Do-Good essays that came out in his brother James's newspaper, the New England Courant. And Franklin was still an indentured servant at the time, and he was afraid that his brother wouldn't take these essays seriously if James knew that Ben was the author. And so he needed to submit them as under pseudonyms. And also in Silence Do-Good and some of his other religious writings in particular, he was concerned because if his skeptical views became known and associated with him, that could be damaging to his career and his public reputation. And so that's why I think often he would write under pseudonyms, is because he was it was a little embarrassing to be associated with the kind of skeptical views he was propounding.
Now, how did James not know that it was Ben? Did Ben, like, come back late at night and slip the Silence Do-Good essays under the door saying, hey, look what I found in the morning?
That's exactly what he did. Yeah. I mean, at least that's what he tells us he did in the autobiography. Sometimes I think, the autobiography is being written much later. I'm sure some of it is stylized and nostalgically remembered. But somehow I think he was able to keep it from James that he was the author of the Silence Do-Good essays. And if we're to believe Franklin's account of this, that they were being published without James knowing that his younger brother was the author.
Now, the name Silence Do-Good actually has a specific meaning that relates to a religious pastor at the time. So give us a flavor for what and this tells us a little bit about his mind, of his kind of comic aspect of him.
Right. Well, Silence Do-Good was a widow character. It was, he's taking on the voice of a woman. And that name was based on a couple of publications by Cotton Mather, who was into the early 1700s, was one of the most influential pastors in Boston. And so Silence Do-Good was kind of a joke on his writings, the silence, being that Cotton Mather wrote so much that he was many things, but definitely not silent. And he also had a publication that had silence as part of its title. And then probably Mather's most influential writing for Franklin was a book called Essays to Do Good. And so Franklin was actually not that hostile towards Cotton Mather, but partly because Mather is a traditional Christian, but he insists that, as I think most traditional Christians would, that even though that we're saved by grace, but God's grace empowers us to do good works. And so Mather was proposing a variety of ways to do the most good for the most number of people. And a lot of people at the time are calling for people to be creative and entrepreneurial about the way that they try to help the poor, help various disadvantaged people. And Franklin loved that. So even though he and Mather would not agree on the way that people are saved, he definitely likes Mather's ideas about the essays to do good.
He starts to develop a theological understanding that's based on ethics at this time, rather than by God's grace we are saved. He starts to think more in terms of Christianity as an ethical system. Inform us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I call it in the book a doctrineless, moralized Christianity. And what I mean by that is that for Franklin, virtually all doctrines become negotiable. I mean, I suppose Franklin would have agreed that if there is no God, there can be no version of Christianity. But for him, everything gets focused on morality, and especially what he would call virtue, the service of your fellow man. I mean, he finds even the worship of God, even though he admits in his late letter to Ezra Stiles that God should be worshipped, he finds even the worship and singing and praying and these kind of things to be impractical. And so what he's most interested in is service and charity and taking care of the least of these. He sees that as the essence of true Christianity. And so, you know, these ideas about God and God's sovereignty and salvation and these kind of things, he doesn't say, you know, don't believe in those things. He's more saying, believe what you want, but what we do know is that God wants us to do good to others. So, I mean, people reading my book, you know, traditional Christians reading my book, I think would say, well, that's probably not Christianity, but Franklin thought that it was. I mean, and so I don't try to solve that debate in the book. But he thought what he was doing was getting down to the essence of what real Christianity is.
Now, I have to bring this one up because I think this was one in his Silence Do Good essays, but it might have been some of his other writings. He is certainly bucking the trends with a lot of things, and as his parents pulled him out of school, which cut off the path to Harvard University, he had some snarky things to say about Harvard, and I have to quote him by saying that Harvard was a mind-numbing holding tank for children of wealth. What a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful statement. Some things never change, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
And we love you, Harvard. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely developed a kind of anti-elitist strain that very much comes from his personal background, but also the sting of not having access to college education, I think, made him more critical of Harvard and institutions like it, though later in his life he would receive honorary degrees from virtually every major college, including Harvard and Yale, because of his scientific accomplishments. And then in the 1750s gets an honorary doctorate from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, after which he's always called Dr. Franklin. But part of his strange friendliness with a number of evangelicals, including the preacher George Whitefield, I think, have to do with his sense that, well, I may not believe exactly the same things as these evangelicals do, but this kind of religion really resonates with the people much more than the sort of highfalutin version of Christianity that they teach at Harvard College in the 1700s.
Let's get up to that point. George Whitefield becomes a very important influence in his formation, becomes a very good friend as well. But in between the time of his teenage rebellion and meeting Whitefield, he takes a couple sojourns abroad and then comes back and spends some time in Philadelphia. Tell us about that period. That's roughly his 20s or so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, late teens and early 20s. He goes for about 2 years to London. He's trying to set himself up in a printing business in Philadelphia, and for a variety of reasons thinks that he needs to go to London, but he's sort of cut adrift. The Pennsylvania governor makes him some promises that he doesn't keep, and so he's kind of left high and dry in London and starts working for some printers in London. This is the time when he really, I think, goes the furthest, both into skepticism and also probably into the most kind of immoral, scurrilous behavior. It's not unusual. I mean, you have a sort of a rootless young man, late teens, early 20s, in the great metropolis of London. And he's very transparent about going to prostitutes there. At some point in those years, he ends up with an infant son. We don't know who the mother is, but this is his son William, who ends up going on to become the governor of New Jersey. But he's really, I think, testing the boundaries of both radical skepticism and sort of sowing his wild oats. And by the time he gets done with that and is on his way back to Pennsylvania, I think he's kind of sick of it. He thinks that this kind of, I mean, you think of Franklin, and even later in his life, you know, he's palling around with these French ladies and so forth, and you think of him as kind of a good time man through most of his life, but he's actually, he has a kind of Puritan moralistic streak in him from his childhood, but it's also connected to his belief that if you are just indulging the flesh all the time and doing whatever you feel like doing, that will destroy you eventually, which I think is true. And Franklin becomes convinced that he needs to become committed to what he calls a plan of conduct, a code of virtue that doesn't have to do necessarily with belief in his parents' religion, but certainly their ideals of virtue, the Ten Commandments, the Beatitudes, these kind of codes of how one should live become very important to Franklin, so much so that he draws up this plan for how he can manifest these virtues, and he kind of keeps tabs on how he's doing with regard to humility and these kind of things. So that he doesn't have a born-again experience ever that we know of, but I think that's the closest that he gets to having a kind of religious or at least virtuous kind of conversion experience, where he resolves, now I'm going to be hardworking, honest, frugal, and that feeds straight into what a successful printer he becomes in Philadelphia.
And speaking of the plan of conduct, one of the things that I learned in reading this book that I thought was utterly fascinating and hadn't known about before, but when he returns from London, he gathers a group of friends or colleagues in the printing business and thereabouts, and they're called the Junto. Who are these folks, and what kind of role do they have on his intellectual and spiritual formation?
Well, this tells you a lot about what kind of man Franklin is that he gathers this group of friends. Most of them are sort of tradesmen, up-and-coming tradesmen in Philadelphia, who want to get together and discuss philosophical and sometimes religious topics, to have a very open-minded kind of approach to these things, so certainly not sectarian, and they would ban sort of theological arguments about things, but they would propose and debate and read about the big theological and philosophical topics of the day, and wanted to have an outlet for young men in Philadelphia to be able to discuss these things. Usually this was seen as something only the college-educated or the pastors who are college-educated would have the time and resources to be able to do. But Franklin wanted to bring that into availability for people like him, up-and-coming tradesmen who he thought should be up to speed on the latest philosophical discussions. And they would also discuss ways to do good, ways so that they can help people, ways that they can be creatively charitable. So it's very reflective of Franklin's kind of mindset there after he returns from London.
A lot of this comes through in terms of his writing of perhaps of his most famous work, the Poor Richard's Almanac, which is produced on a regular basis as kind of ongoing newspaper, more or less. And he uses a lot of aphorisms. You point out in your book, too, that he is lacing this through with a lot of biblical imagery, much as you mentioned earlier, that they were kind of worked in as anecdotes and jokes in there. So tell us a little bit about how his spirituality manifests in his printing business.
Well, he's always printing large numbers, even before he connects with George Whitefield. He's printing a lot of religious material, hymnals, sermons, theological texts, because they were popular. I mean, he's serving his audience, so he wants to print what they want to buy. And so that sort of material worked well. And you can see it show up in even in Poor Richard's Almanac, Almanacs were very, very popular and common at the time. All the colonies had various kinds of almanacs. And the core of the almanac was a calendar. But the calendars would have various dates marked as significant. The Puritan almanacs would never mention church history, or they wouldn't even list Christmas and things like that because they didn't think that was biblical. Franklin is catering to a more flexible kind of audience, and many of his customers would be Anglicans, and so he has a lot of material in his almanacs about the Anglican church calendar. One of the funniest things, or most peculiar things to readers today, especially people who are not intimately familiar with the church calendar, is that in his first almanac, the first line, January 1st, 1733, the calendar just said the word circumcision next to it. Mm-hmm. You think, what in the world is that? If we have any Anglican listeners, maybe you know that January 1st is considered to be the feast of the circumcision of Christ. And, you know, it's considered to have been circumcised 8 days after his birth on Christmas. But, you know, Franklin lives in a world where you don't have to explain what circumcision on January 1st is doing there, you know. Where to us that seems odd. So that just shows how religion is woven in. And Franklin doesn't even have to give much thought to this. So of course, you put these major holidays and so forth, holy days, into the calendar, because that's the way that faith structures time in Franklin's world.
Now, you already mentioned this name here, and it's a huge influence on him, George Whitefield. And yeah. You've written on George Whitefield before, and you can see the intersection where these two characters really come together in almost a perfect storm, that Franklin is a prolific printer, Whitefield is a prolific sermonizer, and they kind of connect. And tell us about that relationship.
Well, George Whitefield is the most important evangelist of the Great Awakening of the 18th century, and he is so successful that he becomes really arguably the most famous person in Britain and America in the 1740s. I suppose more people know the name of the King of England, but more people have seen Whitefield, have read Whitefield's stuff, have gone to Whitefield's meetings, and so he's just a titanic celebrity, and he's the most famous, not the most famous religious person, but the most famous person of any kind at the time. And Franklin starts to hear about Whitefield because in the late 1730s, Whitefield is preaching places in London, and there are crowd sizes that are being reported in the tens of thousands, occasionally even 60, 70, 80,000 people coming to hear Whitefield. And of course, this is in an era before amplification and electricity. I mean, Franklin's working on the electrical part of things, but his sermons are not being amplified, and so it's just unbelievable, this number of people coming to hear him. And Franklin, as you would expect, is skeptical. He thinks, you know, this guy's probably a phony in these crowd sizes and everything. So when Whitefield finally comes to America for his great preaching tour in the late 1730s, Whitefield seeks out Franklin because Whitefield and his publicist are looking for good, creative publishers to work with in America. So people tell him to go talk to Franklin about this, and so Franklin gets the right to publish some of Whitefield's stuff, and in time becomes Whitefield's most important publisher in America. And Franklin comes to believe that Whitefield is the real deal. Not only is he so famous, but that Franklin likes Whitefield, even though he doesn't agree with some of Whitefield's preaching about, you know, salvation by grace alone, and you have to experience conversion in order to be saved. But Franklin goes to a number of Whitefield's revival meetings, and in one that he recounts in the autobiography, while everyone else is listening to Whitefield preach on the courthouse steps in Philadelphia, Franklin is on the edges of the crowd. And he is trying to figure out exactly how many people can hear Whitefield preach at the same time. And so he's giving everybody this many square feet and then walking back to see how many people might actually be there. And Franklin says that he thinks that actually something like maybe 30,000 people actually could hear Whitfield preaching at one time. And so because of that, Franklin becomes much more sympathetic to Whitfield and you know, all these reports about Whitfield's success. And Franklin actually, you know, starts becoming quite sympathetic to Whitfield's charitable work. And in particular, Whitfield is interested in founding an orphanage in Georgia. And Franklin goes on to give money to help out Whitfield with the orphanage.
Just a side note to all of our budding social scientists out there, as you recount what Franklin was doing to figure out how big his audiences were, what a wonderful social science methodological technique. He says, how many people could do this? Well, let's go and stand and look at 2 square feet and just keep walking back until I can hear it. That's
right.
That's some amazing methodology there. So take note, you graduate students. How else does Whitfield really influence Franklin, and who are some of the other characters around here at the time that play a role in this?
Well, of course, Whitfield and Franklin's relationship starts as this business relationship, and Franklin goes on to publish enormous amounts of Whitfield's material, especially his travel journals, which are phenomenally popular, and his sermons. And Franklin makes an enormous amount of money off of publishing Whitfield's stuff. I mean, between the Poor Richard's Almanacs and his newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, and Whitfield's materials, Franklin makes so much money that he's able to retire early in the late 1740s and pursue, among other things, his scientific experiments full-time. So Franklin is delighted with this, and over time, Whitfield and Franklin move from an exclusively business kind of relationship to a personal friendship. And as part of that, Whitfield certainly reserved the right to ask Franklin about the state of his soul. And Whitfield knew that Franklin did not believe in Jesus, at least not the biblical understanding of Jesus as the Son of God. And so Whitfield would tell him, he would say, you know, you need to believe in Christ for salvation. You need to be born again. He would be very direct with Franklin. And I think Franklin, to his credit, wasn't touchy about that. He knew that he understood that they weren't on the same page about this. And Whitfield was respectful but direct with him. And Franklin was fine with that. And Franklin would push back and say, you know, I'm fine. I think God will be gracious to me. And so they had kind of a nice understanding that way. And then as Franklin became more and more famous because of his scientific experiments, they had a common experience of celebrity. I think that they both understood what it was like for all these thousands and thousands of people to know who you are. And they identified with that. And I think when Whitfield died in 1770, Whitfield ended up dying quite a bit before Franklin did. I think Franklin was genuinely grieved and said in a personal private letter that he loved Whitfield as a friend, and he was really, I think, very attached to Whitfield. So it's a very unusual friendship in the context of the 18th century. But that just shows, you know, that Franklin, in a strange way, is a really key figure in the evangelical movement of the 18th century. Even though he was not an evangelical, he's arguably the most important publisher of evangelical materials, not just Whitfield's, but some others too, in the mid-18th century. So it's an extraordinary thing.
Speak about this latter half of his life. Most of the book is really devoted to this earlier spiritual formation as he's a young child, but we move up toward the revolutionary era, and as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, he starts to see Providence playing more of a role in American history during the revolutionary time and then coming up to the Constitutional Convention. So where is he spiritually? How is he changing? How is he evolving during this?
once Franklin becomes a diplomat and goes to London in the 1750s, he spends most of the second half of his life in England and France, France starting in the 1770s. And during those times, I mean, he's very busy with diplomatic affairs, and so whereas in the 1730s, Franklin had written as an author an enormous amount on theology and religion, engaging theological debates among Presbyterians and in Philadelphia in the 1730s, Franklin becomes more quiet about religion, with some very notable exceptions in the second half of his life, and certainly does not want to be known in the second half of his life as a skeptic or an antagonist of traditional Christians. He's moved past that, and I think his relationship with Whitfield is an important change in that kind of posture that Franklin takes. Franklin is, of course, swept up into the events leading up to the Revolution, tries to stay supportive of the British for as long as he can, but by the mid-1770s becomes convinced that America will have to declare independence and fight a war against Britain. And all that, and of course the war itself, is all very heavy for Franklin and all the founders who were involved, everyone who's involved in the war, the Patriot Movement. They sense the weight of what's going on. And the prospect that America could become a new nation, improbably, it seems at the outset foolish to try to fight against the British. That's one of the reasons why they're reluctant, is they think they'll be wiped out and destroyed. But as it becomes clearer that America is going to become its own nation, I think Franklin and a number of the founding fathers who might have been more reticent about ideas about providence come to believe that God must be working some way in this history of the Revolution and America's independence, and then in the late 1780s, the framing of the Constitution. It's just the weight of the circumstances that they go through, I think, brings Franklin, brings others like James Madison, I think, back to a more traditional view of providence. They just can't keep up this idea that this has nothing to do with the workings of God in their history. So I think the weight of the events of the Revolution, his responsibilities as a diplomat, of course, Franklin goes on to secure the alliance with France in the late 1770s. That's key to America winning the Revolution. The violence of the war, Franklin grows very, very angry at the British and at King George III because of the way that they prosecute the war. Franklin is struggling with his health. He's even though he lives a long time, he has terrible health issues he's struggling with, and that turns his mind towards the afterlife. And he becomes more convinced over time that there really must be something to God's providential role in America's history and maybe even in his own life.
One of the things that you bring out in the latter chapters here, and it's an interesting observation, while Franklin is becoming more and more interested in the role of providence, he also notes that God isn't interested in the smaller details of history, which allows a lot more free agency or free will to be acting. And it seems to me to be a culmination of his early rebellious spirit with his maturing Christianity at the time. Thoughts on that?
Well, he's never going to come over to a kind of view that George Whitefield or Jonathan Edwards, the other great New England preacher of the Great Awakening, have about God's meticulous providence, that God is holding everything together, that God, as it were, you know, has his hand in every single thing, even the movement of atoms. Edwards says that God is involved in that directly, and that if he withdrew his hand, everything would spin apart and cease to exist. I mean, Franklin thinks that's extreme. But I think as he looks at those more macro kind of events, he comes to believe, how can God not be involved? How can God not be behind this, at least in some kind of mysterious way? So you know, Franklin never has enough confidence theologically to say that he can identify exactly how God is working in exactly these events, but he also thinks it's foolish to deny that God must be behind something as improbable and shocking and of world historical significance as the American Revolution.
Let's finish up here with some of your final reflections. One of the correctives that your book offers is that Franklin was a lot more theologically deep than the typical image painted of him today by many scholars. And this is true for a lot of the founding fathers. We've talked about some of these folks on earlier podcasts. But some folks would say, you know, we're living in a more secular world now, and the vestiges of religiosity are bygone days and not really relevant for the zeitgeist of today. So why write this book to illuminate Franklin's religiosity? Does it really matter anymore? Can we just kind of forget this? Or does Franklin's history really have something to say to us in today's time?
Well, I think that one thing is just, we need to know exactly what role that faith played in the American founding, because that subject is so fraught and debated. It's one of the most heated historical debates that comes up constantly in American politics. And you have some, conservative, Christian politicians who will say, well, America was founded as a Christian nation, and therefore we ought to do this and such. And then more secular critics will say, no, the founders were all secular deists at best, and that, you know, religion didn't really matter to them. As usual, the historical truth is a little more complicated than politicians and pundits would want to make it today. And you see that with somebody like Franklin, who, yes, he's a deist of a certain kind. We know he is because he tells us he is. But the influence of faith, his belief in the need for virtue, are powerful themes in Franklin's life increasingly over his life. And so even if someone like Franklin believed that, set aside mention of people like Patrick Henry, who was a devout Christian, if Franklin believed that, then that seems to have been an important part of the founding, even though for sure the founding fathers were not all traditional Christians. They were not all on the same page with regard to faith. But they all, I think, would have affirmed the value of virtue for the life of the Republic. And so if America today is headed in a direction of valuing, for many people, a kind of individualism that you know, morality doesn't really matter as long as you don't hurt other people, I think, you know, Franklin is instructive of somebody who would have cautioned us to say, no, I mean, a smaller Republican political system really depends on a virtuous citizenry, and that is not something that we can give up easily and still be in accord with the vision of the founders on those issues.
Always get wonderful reflections from the historians that I have on our show, and Professor Thomas Kidd is one of the best ones out there, and I recommend that you pick up his many different books on this. My guest has been Professor Thomas Kidd. Tommy, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.